Welcome to Truth Will Out Radio. Today's date is Friday, the 11th of September, 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live tonight at RadioAlbion.com. Because normally we would have Dennis Wise with us, but unfortunately he's still unable to make podcasts. He's just too tired. He basically has a condition which is causing him a lot of fatigue and a lot of discomfort. He has left a message for us saying that he's got an appointment at the hospital, a day appointment, and hopefully things are going to start to improve, but unfortunately he can't make podcast just yet. But I am very pleased to say that we do have with us tonight the author of Hellstorm, who we've been going through for the last 3 weeks, Scout Dance, War to the Knife, Bloody Dawn, The Darkest Dawn and Summer, 1945, Germany, Japan and The Harvest of Hate, which we will be looking at tonight. Mr. Thomas Goodrich. Thomas, good evening, sir. How are you doing?
Very good, Sven. How are you doing?
Yeah, pretty well. I'm just really, really grateful to you for stepping in and making these podcasts with me, because there is nobody else that I would be able to make them with on these sort of subjects. And these are the subjects that I'm used to talking about with Dennis. I mean, it's just, you're an absolute godsend being here at this time. You really are.
Well, thank you so much. That makes me feel very wanted. But I'm sure that when Dennis gets back, everybody's going to enjoy that. Dennis, by the way, if you're listening, hang in there. I'll hang in here as long as I can. But we're looking forward to your return, my friend. So take care of yourself.
Yeah, he's listening, and he's really grateful that you've been making these podcasts with us as well. He said to send his thanks to you and also to the listeners, everybody who's been sending in his well wishes. And he's he's been enjoying the last few podcasts that we've done. We've gone into lots of great detail on Hellstorm. And I've heard you speak about Hellstorm before, but you've written another book since then, which I wasn't actually aware of until you told me about it a couple of weeks back. And that's sort of known as Hellstorm Part 2. And that deals with Japan as well as Germany, and a sort of continuation on from what was happening in Germany in 1945. The book's called Summer 1945, Germany, Japan, and the Harvest of Hate. So what really prompted you to go back into this, Tom, after the grueling experience that was writing Hellstorm 1?
Well, Sven, to be quite honest, I was aware that I had a lot more material out there, and I knew there was a lot more information to be dug up. And I realized Hellstorm, the first Hellstorm, that is, left a lot of things out that I wanted to include. And in fact, our mutual friend Andy Hitchcock had suggested that instead of the title that now exists, Summer 1945, that we probably should rename it Hellstorm 2. And I agree with Andy. And in fact, if I get the opportunity to re-edit this book, I'll probably just call it Hellstorm 2, Summer 1945, the death of death of, when, in other words, it's carrying on the same. I wanted to, this was the most important, though. Although the book does talk about Germany again, of course, I wanted to make sure that in this edition, I got what needs to be said about Japan, the war in the Pacific with the Americans, the Australians, the British, and the Japanese, because I had done a little cursory research on this. So I knew something of what was about to come in it. But it was very much like the Hellstorm book on Germany alone. I realized in that book that there was almost everything they said about Germany was untrue. And I knew nothing about that until I began the research for Hellstorm. Well, the same goes for Summer 1945, Germany, Japan, and the Harvest of Hate. I knew absolutely nothing except what I'd been told about the war with Japan. And that was that and what needed yet to be said about Germany was the impetus for this book, Summer 1945. And as stunned as I was by the information I got from Hellstorm, the first book, I can honestly say that it was not as great as my being startled by what I found out about the war with Japan. I was utterly ignorant. Yes, and let me first say this. I grew up in the shadow of World War II. I was not alive during the war, but after it, like other kids my age in America, and I'm assuming in Great Britain, we grew up understanding that war, what we thought that war was about. It was everywhere. It was on TV and in movies. It was our fathers themselves who brought home their guns, their uniforms, things like that. And everything we'd heard about World War II, that's what we believed. Let's face facts. That's exactly what we believed because it was our elders telling us about it. It was also in the books and the movies. And how can you disagree with so much when it's out there like that? Well, not everybody has the good fortune, I suppose, the luxury of becoming a historian, actually writing and researching about these subjects. And I'm very grateful that I did have that time to go into it because I would have hated to go through this whole entire spin on this globe not knowing the truth. I'm grateful that I was given the ability and the time to research these subjects and satisfy myself that I now know what happened in World War II from both sides, not just the side that won, but from the two sides that lost. And we'll talk about some of the revelations that came to me in when I was researching the Japanese part of the book. And by the way, I should say, Summer 1945 is still for sale, I think, on Amazon and some other places, Barnes & Noble, big stores like that. But it is a book that, very much like the original Hellstorm, it uses the words of the people themselves. I think it's the best way to tell a story, especially when you're dealing with history. A writer, especially with a writer with an agenda, can do so much with words that it really doesn't become history anymore. If they're telling just the falsehoods of the winning side, it becomes a piece of propaganda, a press release, if you will. But when you allow the people themselves to do the talking in a book like Hellstorm and now Summer 1945, it's very difficult to disagree with these people, especially the ones that are the victims, the ones being bombed and blasted and bayoneted and raped and tortured, mutilated and starved. It's very difficult to argue with their words when it's in their words and there's no doubt in your mind. And when you can look up the sources themselves, like a good history book is annotated. There are notes somewhere in the book that tell the reader what they're reading is true. It comes from this source. If you do not believe that, go to this source and you can find out for yourself. And so that's what that's the impetus behind both Hellstorm and Summer 1945. But certainly we'll talk about a few of the things that were just incredible to me, almost unbelievable things that I found out from this book. The book, by the way, Summer 1945, anyone with a little bit of history in their head would probably realize Summer 1945, that's the first summer of peace for Germany. And then they might think, but for Japan, hey, that was still war. So the Summer 1945 addresses Germany during the first summer of peace, which, as we all know by now after reading Hellstorm, it was not a summer of peace at all. It was called peace, but it was merely an extension of the war itself. So it wasn't the summer of peace, and nor was Japan, of course. Japan was technically still at war all the way until August of 1945. But the way I dealt with that in this book was that I went back and forth. One chapter was devoted to Germany and peace, so-called, and another chapter, the next chapter, would be what Japan was going through at that time in that same period, whether it was April or May or June of the summer of 45. And Japan, of course, they experienced everything that Germany had experienced in that last summer of peace for the Japanese, and then some, quite honestly, and then some. Well, I would have thought no nation could have. Yes.
Just simply say, what really surprises me, Thomas, is with the German stuff, you don't find the information about the terror bombing. You don't look on Wikipedia and you find out about the rapes. You don't read about the Red Army on Wikipedia. You can't find this information anywhere. But I was really shocked today to be looking up some background information on this and discover that Wikipedia tells about all these horrific things that the Americans did. And I'm just amazed that, because I know there must be even worse things that are not on there. But the really surprising thing I found is that it is actually covered, these horrific things that the Americans were doing to the Japanese, cutting bits of their bodies off, making body ornaments out of them. This is obviously where the idea came from for that demonstration that they did at Buchenwald, and they were showing that there were skeleton parts that were used as ashtrays and the human skin lampshades. And I think the idea for that probably came from the American soldiers that were doing things like that to the Japanese, cutting bits of their body off and making necklaces out of their ears, drying the skulls out and even sending the skulls back home. And this stuff is covered in Wikipedia. That's what really shocked me about this, is that this side of it, this Japanese side of it, was actually there in the mainstream, although, as I say, I expect maybe, you know, you dug up a lot worse, but I didn't know it was there. Didn't know it was there at all.
You know, Sven, by the way, for our audience, I would say that Sven did send me the Wikipedia source he's talking about, and I read it. I had never seen that before. And I, of course, the ego in me wants to believe that maybe something I wrote in summer 1945 resonated with enough people that they actually put that in there on Wikipedia. I hope that's the case. Or I hope that there's enough being written now that would verify for these folks, at least on Wikipedia. And I think we all know what their real agenda is all about, that they couldn't ignore the subject. But yes, in fact, the Japanese, let me say this about the subject you're talking about right now. You know, the Japanese were probably the most vilified enemy the United States has ever faced, ever. And there's for a number of reasons, and I want to start by stating the obvious. Pearl Harbor was probably the greatest false flag to ever occur in history, period, not just in American history. It was a false flag. It was a deliberate setup. It had been foisted upon the Japanese long before, in the 1930s, after they had sought colonies in Southeast Asia and China and Manchuria. And especially after they had signed a non-aggression treaty with Germany, basically becoming allies with Germany, Nazi Germany. Of course, we know what the propaganda was like in the 30s against Germany. We can look back and see the Jewish press, the Jewish media, Hollywood were already stoking the fires for an anti-German crusade to come. And so when Japan and Germany signed a non-aggression treaty, nevertheless, they had become allies. Then, of course, that put Japanese square in the crosshairs, the Japanese square in the crosshairs of the Americans from that point on. And the Jewish lobby in America, of course, the people who surrounded FDR, his allies and advisors. And so the sights were set on Japan after their signing with Germany, this treaty. But what had happened to Japan, I'll try to make this as brief as possible, is that the Americans began to try to goad Japan into a war of aggression, because they had done everything they could, the Americans that is, to antagonize the Germans. They had done various things. For instance, not the least of which was actually depth charging German submarines, even though America was technically neutral. Doing things like that, hiding the resources, stopping the resources, doing various things. And don't forget, the anti-German propaganda was going full boat in America at the same time. And so and the Germans didn't respond. Hitler was way too smart to fall into a trap like that. So no matter what the Americans did against the Germans before the war started, Hitler was not going to step into that. But then with Japan suddenly becoming an ally, the Americans saw what they thought was an opportunity. Let's do what we can with Japan and see if they won't come in by the back door, allowing us to come in by the back door to fight Germany. And that was always the real object of World War II. It was not Japan. It was Germany. It was to stop Germany and Hitler and Nazism. Because what Hitler had done during the 30s was something that FDR and the other leaders of the so-called democracies could not do. And that was revitalize his people and just become great, whereas the other nations were starting to really fall and slip. And, of course, we know a little bit about the banks. But back to Japan. The British and the Americans, first of all, they accused Japan of being a heartless colonizer by taking over land in China and Manchuria and Southeast Asia. And, of course, the Americans never mentioned this, but they had been in the colonizing business for decades prior to this. And they had no problem whatsoever, apparently, colonizing these nations. But the Japanese, when the Japanese did it, the Americans made a big issue out of it. And they, of course, the embargo upon Japanese raw products that the Americans had foisted upon them, that set the Japanese back, of course. They were trying to become an industrialized nation. They admired the British colonial system. They wanted to be like the British, by the way. And they felt that they were the leaders, natural leaders of Asia, and it was their right to do this. But the British and the Americans did other things against the Japanese. For instance, right toward the end, the Americans actually sent in naval vessels to try to incite an incident with the Japanese. But the Japanese had tried peace over and over, tried to stop this. And their only alternative toward the end, toward Pearl Harbor, was to basically stop, get out of their colonies, and not become an industrialized nation, not become a leader of Asia. That was one option, and of course that was insufferable. They weren't about to do that. Or it was simply to fight and hope for a quick victory and set the Americans back. Well, that's where Pearl Harbor came in, and although FDR in his famous speech called it a I forget the terminology, but he basically said there's no greater more terrible people in the world than Japan for this sneak attack at Pearl Harbor. It was unprovoked, blah, blah. It was certainly not unprovoked. It was totally provoked, and that's exactly what the Americans wanted and the British. And so with the declaration of war against Japan and Hitler's declaration of war against America, which that's what their treaty with Japan stated, basically, somebody attacks and fights you, they attack and fight us. And that's where they got in through the back door, through Germany. Now, that said, the sneak attack, as we've heard about Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor, was not a sneak attack at all. It was a surprise attack, that's for sure. But the Americans knew all about it. They knew that there was an attack coming very soon, within a week or so, they knew. And so it wasn't a surprise to the leadership, FDR and his cronies. But you can imagine how easy it was for the propagandists in America to stoke this fire about the sneaky Japs, the dirty Japs. That was the most common term they used. The terrible thing they had done attacking America, sneaking and attacking them. And so with the propaganda mill running and with the war started, it was an easy thing to dehumanize the Japanese and turn them into something that deserved only murder and death and slaughter. And you were talking about the Wikipedia article about the trophies that Americans would take from the Japanese. Let me say this first and foremost. The propaganda was so great that the military leaders, the government leaders, even the Americans themselves felt that there should be no mercy shown whatsoever to the Japanese, whether they be soldiers or civilians. The demand was to kill them outright. No mercy, just a total black flag upon the Japanese. And that's the way it developed. Beginning with Guadalcanal, the first island that the Americans attacked and occupied, basically, it was no quarter. They were ordered by their officers. Now, this wasn't in writing because everybody knew that you can't get away with that, just actually stating a fact like that. It was said, it was spoken, it was understood that we will take no prisoners. And beginning with Guadalcanal, one of the first things people saw when they came on shore after the initial landing forces had occupied the beach were Japanese heads stuck on poles along a river to designate the this is the no man's land for Japanese, in other words. That was the first thing to occur. And then, of course, everything got more terrible in a hurry. To this very day, this is a revelation that I knew nothing about. In fact, most of the things I'm saying I knew nothing about prior to the research of this book was that we've got this idea that the Japanese always fought to the death, that they weren't afraid of dying, that they would gladly die for the emperor, that they were unhuman type of people that were just simply not like we Americans and we Brits. And that's a falsehood. The Japanese wanted to live as much as any American soldier facing him. Your average 18-year-old dreamed of going back and marrying that girl next door, raising a family, having a home, a car, a pet that he could play with in the backyard. They did that. I know they did that because I've read their diaries. I've read their accounts, their letters home. In other words, far from refusing to surrender, Japanese, especially in places like Guadalcanal that was captured, occupied by the Americans, would have gladly surrendered if they thought they could have survived. But when their comrades, their friends, realizing that it was this fight was hopeless on whatever island they're on, realized that, but we can't surrender. We would surrender, but we cannot, because the moment we come out with our hands up, as happened so many times, we were mowed down by machine guns. And their friends, watching breathlessly from the weeds and the woods and the trees, watching their friends try to surrender, then see them shot down mercilessly with their hands up. That had a wonderful calming effect on the rest of the Japanese army to forget about surrendering. They won't let you surrender. And of course, then you can imagine what happened after that. Japanese did fight to the death, and the Americans used that to their own propaganda, basically saying they won't give up, they won't surrender. Well, that's a lie. That's a damn lie, too. They would have gladly, as Japanese soldiers and officers themselves said, we would have been happy to surrender toward the end of the war when these islands are being taken, and we're a handful against thousands. But we couldn't surrender, so they did fight to the death.
Can I just interrupt there? The reason that they've given in Wikipedia when I was reading through this today, they were saying that they wouldn't surrender because of the sense of honor, because if they lost, then their life was worthless. So when they saw that Americans had surrendered, they thought their life was worthless, so they mistreated them. And, you know, this is something that I've talked about before. In battles before, in ancient times, when you had a battle, and you lost, you either fell on your sword or you accepted slavery, because the humility of actually losing. This is why people would fall on their sword. This is why at the end of the war, Hitler killed himself, because when your victor has got you at his mercy, you're then his slave for the rest of his life, because he gives you your life. You either die or you're a slave for the rest of your life. And I could understand that, you know, the Japanese still had that sense of honor. You can't lose. If you lose, you're his slave for the rest of your life, because that man has given you your life. By rights, he could take it. And this was the excuse that Wikipedia gave for why the Japanese mistreated the Americans, because they would have expected to be mistreated themselves. And I don't think they would have expected to be mistreated themselves, but do you think that a sense of honor may have played into it in some way, that they didn't?
Yes, you're in a bad place if you're a soldier fighting a major war and you don't have some sense of honor. Yes, there is that. But this idea that motivated them totally, hell no, and hell no again, because Japanese wanted to live as much as any people I've ever read about. I've read enough of their diaries of the kids. I'm talking about young people. And as far as Japanese abusing Americans, okay, I've got accounts of Americans saying, no, I've never seen it before, but everybody told me about it, and so the Japs don't deserve to live. In other words, they've heard about Japanese doing terrible things to Americans, starting with Guadalcanal. And soldiers time and time again, no, I haven't seen it, but I've heard enough of it to believe it. So we've got that thing going right now, propaganda among the soldiers themselves, that you never want to fall in the hands of the Japanese because he'll torture you to death. No one had ever seen it. No one had ever, in fact, all they had ever done is heard about it. So you can see how that continues. But back to the Japanese themselves, who were unable to surrender. It was worse than just being killed when you tried to surrender. They also saw things happening from the weeds and the bushes as they watched their friends surrender. They found out what happened to them, who were wounded or who were killed, and what the Americans did to them then. And that goes to the Wikipedia thing you're talking about right now. Yes, the hatred was so uncontrollable, so furious among the Americans, and the discipline was so lax that the Americans did anything they wanted to the Japanese while they were living or while they were dead. One of the biggest things they could do was cut his head off. And then they learned that Navy personnel who later come on the islands were willing to buy the skulls that had been left to meat-eating ants to cure or boiled in hot water to cure the skull himself. And the American soldiers, the Marines and the Army men, sold these, the skulls. And this wasn't just a few. It wasn't an anomaly. It wasn't somebody, a couple of sadistic brutes out there doing this. It was too common to talk about, quite honestly. And when anybody says, like Wikipedia, that some, I would have to say most, because it seemed like virtually everybody was engaged in this. Everybody was talking about it like it was no big deal, like cutting off the fingers or the ears or the nose of Japanese dead or dying was no big deal. And what they would do is dry these and send them back in the mail to relatives back home, or save them and sell them, like the others were selling the skulls. In other words, torture began big time with the first island, Guadalcanal, and then it moved on to other places like Tarawa, Iwo Jima, Okinawa, places like that.
Can I just stop you there again, just to point something mm-hmm. else out? I mean, this is the first time that I've ever heard of anything like this going on, apart from in the Congo, with the Congolese army there. There was a report a couple of years back, a UN report, that they were cutting ears off, and they were cutting genitals off and making necklaces out of ears and genitals and then going into war. And what you've got here, you've got the Americans cutting the ears off and bashing the teeth out and again, wearing the ears as necklaces and wearing body parts as ornaments, mm-hmm, body parts mm-hmm. of the Japanese. And that's something that I associate with the most savage of the savagest races in the Congo, not something that you would associate with American soldiers.
I mean, I know. Hey, I'm an American. My dad was an island hopping Marine, my biological father, who may have done some of the very things we're talking about right now. No doubt he saw them. Perhaps he did them. But that's the nature of this war. That's how brutal the propaganda had become by the time the first island was landed on Guadalcanal. But this idea of throwing still living bodies into latrines, outdoor latrines, along with the dead, throwing them in with the dead, burying live Japanese with the dead. This type of stuff was going on. Nobody thought anything about it, and they were glad they were doing it. Some of the things they say are unbelievable. I agree with you. I say it doesn't sound like Americans, but it didn't sound like any American I knew or thought I knew. And now it sounds very much like the Americans. But anyway, the Americans collected all sorts of body parts from the Japanese. As I think you read in the Wikipedia, somebody even sent FDR an arm bone. I suppose that was used as a Chinese back scratcher or whatever, but he was so proud to get that in the White House, this Japanese arm bone. But there was much worse that went on, and I won't go through everything. Yes, cutting off testicles, things like that, stuffing them in the mouth. But let me read something here real quick. Of all trophies, however, none were more sought out than gold-capped teeth. After any battle or massacre, the mouths of the fallen were often the first stop for many Americans. Like South Sea prospectors, fights broke out when claim jumpers attempted to steal the bodies claimed by others. One excited Marine felt he had struck it rich when he spotted a dead enemy. But, according to the witness, the Japanese wasn't dead. He had been wounded severely in the back and couldn't move his arms. Otherwise, he would have resisted to the last. The Japanese mouth glowed with huge gold-crowned teeth, and his captor wanted them. He put the point of his knife to the base of the tooth and hit the handle with the palm of his hand. Because the Japanese was kicking his feet and thrashing about, the knife point glanced off the tooth and sank deeply into the victim's mouth. The Marine cursed him and with a slash cut his cheeks open to each ear. He put his foot on the sufferer's lower jaw and tried again. Blood poured out of the soldier's mouth. He made a gurgling noise, and thrashing wildly, I shouted, "Put that man out of his misery." All I got for an answer was a cussing out. Another Marine ran up, put a bullet in the enemy soldier's brain, and ended his agony. The scavenger grumbled and continued extracting his prizes undisturbed. But yes, teeth was a, even more than heads, was a prized souvenir. Of course, it had value too. It was made of gold, generally, had lots of gold in it. But this, prospectors searching for gold, more or less, this was, I can guarantee you more people did this than just some, as Wikipedia said. So you've got this going on, and this is the way it goes on and on and on, not just at the one island of Guadalcanal. It goes on and on to every island, and eventually to Okinawa, the last major battle of the war, this type of behavior. And that's the reason I say the discipline was lax or non-existent. It's hard to maintain any kind of discipline, any kind of fighting spirit, I would think, when your people are nothing but a bunch of scavengers, monsters, basically. I know how terrible this sounds to Americans who are listening right now, and the British, by the way. I think the only good news I've got is I don't have a lot of this done by the British. Yes, they did kill prisoners, things like that, but not a terrible lot like the Americans. But this, you know, I'd watched enough John Wayne movies as a kid to know how tough this fighting was. The Japanese did fight well. Of course, if you're, you know, you have no, there's no chance of survival, no surrender, you're going to fight to the death. And they did a lot of that. But they didn't bring out, it showed a lot of Americans killing Japanese, the prisoners, machine gunning them, shooting them to death. But generally, they let it go at that. You know, I'm going to ask you and your listeners, how many Japanese have you seen in prison camps during the war, captured by Americans or British? How many behind barbed wire Japanese have you seen? And I think if you're going to answer me honestly, you're going to say none. And no, that's a pretty good reason.
I can't.
Because they were all killed. Virtually all of them were killed.
I was going to say, Thomas, what you hear about is Japanese mistreatment of American prisoners. And you hear of American prisoners of war and experiments being done on them and them being forced to work. But then, as you say, there's no images whatsoever of Japanese prisoners anywhere. There's stories of American prisoners being mistreated, but just nothing of any Japanese prisoners at all.
It's self-serving propaganda. I'm not going to say Japanese didn't do bad things to America when they did, Americans or British or Aussies when they captured them. I'm not going to say that at all. I'm just saying that beginning with Guadalcanal, most Americans, British, Aussies had never seen Japanese, the results of Japanese torture or killing American prisoners, things like that. They had heard about it, and that's what they were simply going on. To say that the Japanese were somehow much more nobler than the Americans, I can say this. I think they're much more disciplined, obviously, than the Americans, because I don't have any accounts of the things I'm talking about now of what the Americans did to the Japanese. But, you know, you've got this going on, and you've got a type of people, the Americans, basically killing everyone they find. And what it does, what they apparently didn't realize, by creating this terrific fighting force that the Japanese became, was that by showing them no mercy, by killing their prisoners, what you're doing is ensuring that many more of our own men are going to die, because there's nothing left for the Japanese but to fight and fight to the death, to the last bullet. You know, the American soldier on the High Plains of America during the 19th century were fighting the Indians. And the Indians did a lot of the things I'm describing right now of what the Americans did to the Japanese, a lot of those things. And it was also understood that you saved the last bullet for yourself when fighting the Indians, because if you didn't, you would regret it, for the next few days. Is that as long as I kept you alive and kept the torture going, you're going to regret being alive. And so that was the same way with the Japanese. They were simply not going to surrender, and they were going to fight to the bitter end. It was a terrible thing, but I had not heard a thing about this until I did the research. I can't put a, there's, I don't know how to say this. I just, it's a terrible blow to any American when they realize this is what we were doing. And it's not good enough to say dirty Japs, they're animals, they were beasts, they attacked Pearl Harbor, they had the Bataan Death March, things like that, and then accept what they're doing as logical or reasonable. No, it's what propaganda did. It's quite honestly, that's what propaganda will get you, is a bunch of murderous, crazed soldiers who will do anything and everything because they can. And this went on for the entire war, basically. And whether I've got to say this, this is the land armies we're talking about, the Marines and the Army fighting the Japanese Army. But for the most part, this happened also in the air and on the sea. Japanese were simply shown no mercy whatsoever. I do remember seeing one photo or one video, and that was, I only saw that once in my life. But it showed a Japanese sailor whose ship had obviously been sank, who was thrashing about in the water around some debris, swimming in circles, just trying to escape. He didn't know where. And then suddenly, from beyond camera range, the water erupts with machine gun fire. And this Japanese is just beside himself. You can see it in his face, this fear, this incredible a fear that he was showing, and he was swimming in circles, and finally a bullet did hit him in the head and he sank below the waves. But this was going on at sea too. In fact, Americans were strafing, machine gunning hospital ships that are designated hospital ships. They're shooting up lifeboats. A Japanese at sea is in no better position than a Japanese on the land. They're all being killed. And in the air, of course, Japanese bailing out of planes were shot in their parachutes. And so that's what the propaganda got us. It's got, if, I don't know, Americans, let's put it this way. Let's say it the way it should be. Had the American population, the people living in Kansas and Iowa and New York and Florida at the time, had they known this was going on, then what? Would they have demanded that it stop? I think there's a number of good people alive in this country back then that would have asked that it stop. It's got to stop. But for a majority of Americans, and I'm wagering to say 85% of the Americans would have been glad this is going on, would have said, please keep it up. Don't stop. Kill more Japs. Torture more Japs. Throw more dead or living Japs into holes with the dead. Bury them. I think I can say that with a real strong degree of certitude because of what happened all the way through the war, including the nuclear bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima, which we can talk about hopefully if we get enough time. But
can I just say something about the propaganda there? Just about the propaganda. I mean, Wikipedia tries to say that it was all to do with images of the Japanese as rats and dehumanizing cartoons of the Japanese, that is what caused all this bad behavior, which is obviously they're trying to link that to memes today, racial memes today. They're trying to say that leads to this. But from what you're saying, it was the promotion of them being absolutely violent, sadistic beasts and doing these things to the Americans and the attack on Pearl Harbor. It wasn't anything to do with cartoon images of racial caricatures of the Japanese. It was to do with propaganda, actually telling mysteries. And I've seen some of this propaganda. I mean, I can remember probably about 40 years ago seeing American comics, and they may have been 10 or 20 years old, but depicting this war and showing the American prisoners of war in bamboo cages and having all these horrible things that were being done to them. And that is the way that this was told, that it was the Japanese that were mistreating the Americans. There was never any hint that the Americans were doing any of these barbaric things to the Japanese at all. And this was so positively looked upon that it was even in magazines. You know, I just got a quote here, a Life magazine picture of a young woman with a skull trophy. And that was in Life magazine, because these skulls and these trophies and these bits of body parts, as you were saying, Tom, they were sending them back to their girlfriends and to their wives. And then this image that was in Life magazine, seen by, you know, masses of people in America, that was then shown in the Japanese media as a symbol of American barbarism. So this was condoned by the Americans. It has to have been, if it was in a major magazine like Life magazine, young woman with a skull trophy. And it wasn't banned until 1942. They said that they prohibited it. They actually had to prohibit it. And you're talking 1945, so it's still going on 3 years later, isn't it? Obviously, yes, it's condemned.
And the very same things we talked about just recently were still going on, whether they banned it or not, whether they said in print. Now, that's what FDR did after he received that bone, the Japanese bone, in the mail, and the newspapers reported it. And he said, I hope to get a lot more of these later on. He backed away from that. He realized that wasn't good publicity. But nevertheless, I'm sure he still got more bones, whatever he did with them. But this continues. In fact, the reason I know that the same mentality is at work all the way through, other than the research I've done on the books, on the island fighting itself, is the comments after the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Totally unneeded, unnecessary. The war was long over before the bombs were dropped. The Japanese had been trying to surrender that entire year, 1945, and could not, even though their surrender was accepted by the Americans with the same terms as in January of 1945. The comments from the Americans themselves, the civilians, from the slaughter fest at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, they, in fact, there was another bomb soon to be delivered to the Marianas, where the B-29s flew out of, that dropped the atom bombs, had another one on the way for Tokyo, and that was going to be there in about a week. But they had also eight more that was scheduled to arrive, atomic bombs, to be dropped on Japan before November was out. So there was a nuclear holocaust coming to Japan, and the Americans are happy. The American people, that's what the propaganda did to all of us, all the people there. And so, you know, if I've got to get this in, I get it in once in a while when I do interviews like this, is I would love to live to see the day when knowing and willing propagandists who are spouting all sorts of lying, bloodthirsty comments in their propaganda, I'd like to see laws passed against them, and that they would do long prison terms for spilling out such propaganda, because this ultimately gets probably more people killed than a deliberate warlike act itself, as Pearl Harbor was, of course. So, and it doesn't just fall upon the fighting men themselves. It shouldn't fall upon anyone, by the way, fighting men or not. They should be allowed to surrender, like the Geneva Convention dictates. But it's civilians that also suffer. And anybody who's read this book, Summer 1945, knows that this book also talks a lot about the civilians and what happened to them. The murder of civilians on Saipan and Okinawa, and the rape of the women folk on Saipan and Okinawa, and Japan itself after it was occupied by the Americans. So propaganda is one of the greatest diseases in the world today, in my opinion. And it's still getting people, civilians, kids, everybody killed. And there doesn't seem to be any laws against it.
Well, we do. We do have them, but they don't use them against them. We have laws against incitement to violence, incitement to hatred, and they go after individuals for pointing this stuff out instead of going after the big media companies that are inciting violent riots in America as we speak and responsible for inciting all of this stuff and the mistreatment of the Germans, the mistreatment of the Japanese, and it all just is allowed to pass. And we get the victor's justice, where the vanquished foe is then held up in a kangaroo court and made to confess under torture. I mean, what happened to the Japanese? They had a kangaroo court for the Japanese as well, didn't they? At the end of the war, do you know much about that?
Yes, just like Nuremberg. In fact, the parallels between what happened in Germany at the end of their war and what happened to Japan at the end of their war are just striking. It's like a blueprint, like they've got it all lined up. Yes, the Japanese war criminals, so to speak, were put on trial, just like the German war criminals were put on trial, and they were dutifully hung, just like the Germans. But the parallels, just as Hellstorm was one revelation after another when I researched it, so was this book on summer 1945, because I knew nothing about the Japanese, of course. I knew nothing about the war except what I'd seen on TV and movies with John Wayne leading the cast. The air war against Japan. By January 1945, Japan was defeated. In fact, that's why they were suing for surrender, for peace, because they were done. They were through. Their navy had been destroyed. Their air force had been destroyed. Their fighting men were being slaughtered, every one of them, on every island that they had held. But the air war was so similar to what happened in Germany after... You know, the Americans knew they were winning, had won, and they could have agreed to a surrender at any time and still occupied the nation and brought the war criminals to trial. But they were winning, and they liked it. They enjoyed winning. There's no doubt about it. And the American people loved it, as a matter of fact. So the war went on. And the air war against Japan was very similar to the so-called air war against Germany. In other words, the firebombing. Americans ruled the sky. Japanese Zero was a very good fighting plane for the Japanese early in the war, but the Americans outclassed them really quickly. And so the Americans gained air superiority by 1944 at least. But by 1945, there was no question about it. So the Americans, after they had destroyed virtually every Japanese city and after they destroyed virtually all Japanese industry, decided, just as they had done in Germany, well, let's go for the people now. Let's take it to the people. Let's destroy as many of these people as we can, these people who made this war available to the Japanese soldier. And so you've got B-29s flying from the Mariana Islands, which have been captured, of course, by the Americans. B-29s loaded to the gills with phosphorus bombs, fire bombs, bombs to blast every Japanese city, town, and in some cases, villages, actually. Let me give you a real quick classic example of a firebombing in Japan. Tokyo, the first Japanese city firebombed in March, I believe it was, 1945. The Americans came in with roughly, I think, 3,500 B-29s loaded with phosphorus firebombs, circled the city with firebombs so that following B-29s could follow this to their target, and then unloaded roughly, I think it was one, it was a half a million firebombs. They picked a night that was warm and dry and windy. And basically what they did was just incinerate the center of Tokyo, 16 square miles, surrounding the town with fire. The people couldn't escape because they were surrounded. And the horrors of firebombing, I describe it in the book, of course, in the words of the people themselves. But it was incredible. The Japanese, first of all, lived in wooden and paper homes, as I think we most of us know. And they had been prepared for what they considered was normal bombing, that is, blast bombing with bombs that just exploded with shrapnel. So they had no preparation for firebombing. And so their pits that they used for to hide in under normal raids were useless. They were ovens. And the Japanese were forced to flee into the streets as the flames raced along it with hurricane force winds created by the fire itself. And anyway, when the firestorm was finally over, when the Americans did the body count or thought they could, they estimated that anywhere from 100 to 200,000 Japanese died. And these are mostly women, children, and old people. But from my research, what I found out myself and what probably made more sense is, as terrible as the fires were and killing people, it was nothing compared to the water. Believe it or not, water, not fire, probably killed more Japanese because everybody was jumping into anything they could find that was away from the heat, the fire. And many people couldn't swim, of course. Many were young, many were old, and they died in the canals, in the rivers, in the creeks, in the tanks that filled with water to fight fires. They drowned there. And some were just simply swept out to sea and never seen again. But probably more people died from water than fire, actually. And this went on. You know, one thing I want to mention, General Curtis LeMay, a famous American general, he was head of the Air Force then. And this is after, I'm going to read this to you if I can. This was after the dropping of bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And after every Japanese city had been scorched black by the firebombing raids throughout the summer of 1945, the very day that the Japanese were signing the surrender papers with the Americans, the very day, it was actually a few hours before that it was scheduled to sign, but Curtis LeMay enjoyed what his Air Force had been doing to Japan. He enjoyed it so much that he decided to hold one more great raid before the Japanese could sign the papers. And Curtis LeMay sent off roughly 1,000 B-29s loaded to the max with firebombs. And before the last bomber had come back from this raid over Japan, the Japanese signed the surrender. So people died in peace. They started right then dying in peace as they would die over the next several years because of this final raid. This raid by Curtis LeMay of 1,000 airplanes was no more needed than the atom bombs at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. He did it because he could and because it felt good. And the Americans were happy for it, too, because the Japanese were getting exactly what they deserved, according to the Americans. I guess the bottom line, the message of this whole thing is we have got to stop wars because these things continue to this very day. They're going on. This is not ancient history. This is actually modern history, you might say. What was going on in the Middle East in the wars there? The slaughter fest that was going on and turning the people themselves into to be vilified, denigrated, and to be slaughtered en masse. Let me add this. One American hero, and that's James Doolittle, the man who had that very first air raid on Tokyo, the movie they made, 30 Seconds Over Tokyo, James Doolittle. He refused to participate in this final savage air raid of Curtis LeMay. He actually kept his men, the U.S. 8th Air Force, back at their bases rather than go out, risk their lives, but also it's not needed to be killing more women and children. So there's a real hero for you, Curtis. And but anyway, man, I go on because, well,
it's important to this is a thing. I mean, you're saying you want to stop wars, you want to stop the promotion of them. This is why it's important that we challenge what the mainstream media is telling us. This is why it's important you take an interest in what's going on politically, what's going on the international stage, you know, things that are going on in Belarus at the moment, the aggressions towards Russia all along Russia's border. You've got NATO playing their war games. I did a program with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson on it yesterday. All of this is going on, and we've got the propaganda today telling us that Russia has just poisoned Navalny. What on earth would he be doing that for? I mean, it's milder than what was going on here with Japan. But once it heats up, then they'll come out with all these stories, and they'll be telling you how wicked and evil the Russians are. And nowadays, it's more like how terrible the dictator is treating his people, like Bashar al-Assad. Oh, he's gassing his own people. He's terrible to his own people.
Exactly. Yes. And the next time some propagandist comes out and tells us how terrible a certain people are, just tell them, prove it. Prove it to me.
And she's
don't just tell me these
us.
Words and expect me to believe it. Prove it to me.
Yeah, just
give me some
us.
Facts and figures and show me some pictures, some real pictures, not some phony things that you staged on your own. Because that's what these two books, Hellstorm and The Summer 1945, are all about, basically. It's about the propaganda. I mean, I could go on about that. In fact, a really good book ought to be written about just propaganda in war and how beastly that is and how decriminalized the propagandists are. They can get away with anything. They can say anything. And we tend to believe it because we want to believe it, obviously.
Well, this is one of the good things about Trump, isn't it? At least he's called it fake news. At least he calls them out. He calls it fake news. This is all a load of rubbish that you're printing. And at least
he says
that.
It's been fake for quite a while, too, by the way, not just recently. It's been fake for a long time, and let's just don't go any further than Pearl Harbor and look at fake news.
He's the first mainstream person to call it out, and he's the president of the United States. I mean, whatever other failures he's been responsible for, just highlighting the fact that the news is all fake and the mainstream media lies, I mean, you've got to give him credit for that. I'm sure it's woken a lot of people up to it.
Yes,
more than we.
You know, we're talking right now on a date that is 9/11, the anniversary. Before anybody knew anything about what really happened during 9/11, who caused it? Who were the perpetrators? We're off to war. We're off demanding a slaughter fest go on. And this is what I mean, propaganda. I consider Pearl Harbor the greatest false flag in American history, for sure, maybe in world history. But 9/11 comes in pretty close right there at the end, too.
Yeah, they announced who was responsible for it, what it all was before even the towers had finished coming down to the ground. They knew who it was and what was going to need to be done about it. The Pearl Harbor incident, I think that there's a very good, there's a whole chapter in Dennis Wise's documentary, The Greatest Story Never Told, that deals with Pearl Harbor and shows definitively that it was a false flag. So anyone interested in that should look that out. Mm-hmm. But we're coming to the end of the podcast now. Tom, do you want to let people know where they can find your work, Money Tree Publishing, and the new stuff that you've got coming out?
Well, Sven, thank you so much. Yes, and I'll try to be brief. But yes, Hellstorm, the book, and Hellstorm, the audiobook, and Hellstorm, the DVD, the film that is of the book, is for sale at Money Tree Publishing. You can get all three there. It's the first time that's ever happened anywhere that you can actually, if you're interested in the book or the audiobook or the DVD, the film version, you can go to Money Tree Publishing and order one or all of them together. But it's got quite a bit of what we've been talking about today, not necessarily Japan, but about Germany. And maybe eventually it will have Summer 1945 with a new title, Hellstorm 2. That's a very good publisher right now, and it's a beautiful offer, discount prices, things like that. But that's Money Tree Publishing. And give my friend Dave Gaheri there, the editor, a howdy from me. A good man, a great man, actually. But this is a publisher that's ours. Ours totally. It's someone who has given those who have been exiled by Amazon and other book publishers, this is their new home, Money Tree Publishing. So you'll be doing good work by buying anything from this press.
And of course, you're an author. That's how you make your money, is by selling your books. So people can be happy that's where the money is going. It's staying within the movement. It's not being taken off to Amazon or anywhere else. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Tom. Thank you very much to the listeners for listening. We will be back next week with more Truthful Out Radio for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.